From WAMU in Washington and PRX, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie. Coming up, we're going full-on presidential. With Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio entering the race, we check in on the first places all presidential candidates go, Iowa.
We've got a lot of the candidates that are long shots that are getting very, very active.
And New Hampshire.
We're probably the most fiscally conservative state in the country. The debt's always out there.
The media might be chasing Clinton through Iowa this week, but what about her potential challengers? We'll talk to one of them, Rhode Island's Lincoln Chafee, about whether he'll take her on.
I do believe, and that's a big reason I'm running, we have to make the world safer for our children and our grandchildren.
And we talked to former Vice President Walter Mondale, who made history by adding a woman to his presidential ticket.
Although we got clobbered, I think that the message was sent that was deep and profound.
All that and more on this week's episode of The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Link to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us and welcome to episode 72 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It wasn't a traditional campaign announcement. It was buried in an online video, but it was official.
Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead, because when families are strong, America is strong.
Hillary Clinton on Sunday announced her second bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. 8 years ago, she entered the race as the clear favorite, only to be outworked and outsmarted by the new kid on the block, Barack Obama. This time, she's also the favorite, even more so. We're still not sure if there's a Democrat who can keep up with the amount of money, support, and sense of history that Clinton has. It's much more complicated on the Republican side. Three official candidates so far, many more to come, no clear frontrunner at all. The latest is Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who declared on Monday.
I know my candidacy might seem improbable to some watching from abroad. After all, in many countries, the highest office in the land is reserved for the rich and the powerful. But I live in an exceptional country. I live in an exceptional country where even the son of a bartender and a maid can have the same dreams. I live in an exceptional country where the son of a bartender and a maid could have the same dreams and the same future as those who come from power and privilege.
A jab at Jeb Bush, perhaps, but there was no doubt who he was talking about here.
Now, just yesterday, a leader from yesterday began a campaign for president by promising to take us back to yesterday. Yesterday is over.
Later in the program, we go to Iowa and New Hampshire for an early bird look at where the race stands. We also talk to one of the potential Democratic candidates for 2016, former Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee. And if there's a chance history could be made this cycle, the first female president, the first Latino president, we saw history being made in 1984. That was the first time a woman was on the presidential ticket of a major party. The man who made that decision was Walter Mondale, and he's our extra special guest this week. Also this week, President Obama bowed to the inevitable. In the wake of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee's unanimous vote on Tuesday calling for Congress to have a say in the nuclear negotiations with Iran, Obama said he would sign a bill allowing lawmakers to vote on any agreement with Tehran, with the option of a presidential veto should Congress vote it down. And another sign of old Cold War tensions is about to change. The White House said Obama will soon remove Cuba from the list of nations that sponsor terrorism. That decision came in the aftermath of Obama's meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro in Panama last weekend. Finally, we have a date for the special election to succeed Aaron Schock, the Illinois Republican who resigned last month over questions about his campaign spending habits and office expenses. It will be a July 7th primary and a September 10th general election. And it will be held in the state's 18th congressional district, not in Downton Abbey. Much more stuff in this week's program, but first, the trivia question. Hillary Clinton, if elected, would be the nation's first female president. Who was the first woman to win a major party presidential primary? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner, as always, will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And if you want a sneak peek and a head start on each week's trivia question, plus daily updates on the latest news that we're following, head over to our Facebook page. We post the question there a day early. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. And then there were three. Marco Rubio announced on Monday that he's running for president, the third Republican to do so in the past 3 weeks. He joins Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who are already in. And there are more to come. Scott Walker, almost assuredly. Jeb Bush, most likely. Many more definites and definite possibles on the list. Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Lindsey Graham, Chris Christie, Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, John Kasich, Ben Carson, George Pataki, Carly Fiorina. Who am I forgetting? If there's a clear frontrunner on the Democratic side, that's certainly not the case on the Republican side. Do you remember a race as wide open as this one seems to be? I don't. Anyway, Iowa starts it all off with its caucuses slated for Monday, February 1st. Then comes the New Hampshire primary 8 days later. Jeff Kaufman is the Republican state chairman in Iowa. Jeff, welcome to the Political Junkie.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Steve Dupre is on the line. Steve, you're there?
I am here.
Steve Dupre is the Republican national committeeman from New Hampshire.
Jeff, how are you?
I'm fine, Steve. How are you?
We always like to incite the two states to fight against each other, Iowa and New Hampshire. But we always say that Republicans in New Hampshire are more focused on fiscal conservative issues compared to Iowa Republicans who are more focused on social conservative themes. Does that statement seem right to you?
Actually, yes and no. I don't know enough about the what's going on in New Hampshire to say for sure the role of, what the role is, fiscal versus social. I will say this about Iowa. I know it has that reputation for emphasizing social conservatism, and certainly the Christian evangelicals are an important part of our base, but I would just hearken back to the previous caucus from 4 years ago. We had essentially a tie. I mean, Rick Santorum barely pulled it out, but certainly Rick Santorum was someone that emphasized the social issues. On the other hand, Mitt Romney was in a virtual tie with him, and that was certainly not his emphasis. I would say that especially this year, with after the Obama administration, I really think that foreign policy and economic issues, my guess is that for the typical Iowa conservative that's going to participate in the caucus, my guess is those two issues are going to be more on the minds than social issues. Now, obviously, in our western portion of our state, we have more social conservatives over there. But we have a lot of Republicans over in eastern Iowa where if you ask them to number the top five issues, social issues wouldn't even make that list. So bottom line is social conservatism is important in the party, but I don't know that it is the most important.
Steve, let me ask you to follow up on that. Do you think that's a fair characterization of the two states?
Yes. I think Iowa is more socially conservative than New Hampshire. We don't have a large evangelical population here. I saw a recent study that said we were one of the least religious states in the country. And because we have neither an income tax nor a sales tax, the debt and deficit always rank high as important issues in the New Hampshire presidential primary, regardless of whether they register nationally. In fact,
I saw a poll last week, a very reliable poll by one of our potential Republican contenders that said the number one issue was the threat of ISIS in New Hampshire. The number two issue was not just jobs in the economy, but how do we sort of close that opportunity gap that is developing with the lower part of the middle class? And then number three in New Hampshire was the debt. So I think because we're probably the most fiscally conservative state in the country, the debt's always out there. And we've already had candidates being very specific, talking about what they do in terms of entitlement reform. Plus, you have to remember that in New Hampshire, we're sort of a, and I love our cousins in Iowa, but we're a bit more, I think, of a bellwether of a general election because independents can vote, and they are 40% of our electorate. And given the coronation that's going on in the Democratic Party in lieu of a primary, I think you'll see a very heavy turnout of independents to vote in the Republican presidential primary. They tend to be fiscally conservative, more socially moderate.
Jeff, the last time we visited Iowa on this program back in January was during the Conservative Freedom Summit in Des Moines. The headlines were Scott Walker did great, Jeb Bush didn't show. Well, since then, three candidates have announced. Where do things stand right now in Iowa?
We're having our big Republican Lincoln Day dinner on May 16th, and both Walker and Bush will be there. So I think we're seeing a continued blurring of a clear front runner. The polls are very, very tight out here. I believe that Walker has held some of his momentum. There's several candidates that I'm watching. We've got some candidates that you would say have a long shot at winning. Carly Fiorina, for example, Lindsey Graham out here. They are working this. Rick Perry is working it at the grassroots level. I've yet to attend a local county central committee meeting. There wasn't a Rick Perry representative there. And I've yet to go for a week without seeing Carly Fiorina that is headlining a spaghetti dinner or a pancake breakfast somewhere that's sponsored by a Republican Party in the state. So we've got a lot of the candidates that are long shots that are beginning very, very active. Marco Rubio, there was a lot of buildup for his announcement. There was a question whether he was going to announce or not. I think the expectations are high right now. I think it is his to capitalize on. We have not heard a lot from Chris Christie yet, but I understand that he's going to be making a swing through the state. I'll tell you, I really think that this thing is tightening, and I really don't see a clear winner emerging or even a clear front runner emerging before our straw poll in August.
Well, I was going to ask you about the straw poll. I mean, I know it's unscientific, but obviously everybody pays attention to it. It awards no delegates, but it gets tons of newspaper headlines. 4 years ago, Michelle Bachmann won, and she hasn't been heard from since. What's it looking like now? Is there anybody who's impressing you the most?
It depends. You know, the straw poll is such a different animal. You are exactly right. There is nothing scientific about it. It's a snapshot in time among a fraction of our most active Republicans. So the predictability value is, I always considered a family-oriented picnic with a straw poll to enhance. And I really think that the candidates, and to some degree the media, quite frankly, need to control expectations of what it is a little bit better, because the party out here certainly takes it for what it is, and that is a fun poll. In terms of who could likely win this thing, we don't even know for sure who is going to participate. This thing succeeds if candidates participate in it. We have not issued formal invitations yet. My best guess is that we're going to have a few of the candidates not participate. It's a test of organizational strength. We've had Ben Carson out here organizing with Run Ben Run for over a year. Rick Perry is certainly getting his grassroots planted. Rand Paul certainly has a kind of a natural organization that was held over from his dad. So I would say those three are set up pretty well for a straw poll-like event. But, the script is still waiting to be written on that.
Steve, have the candidates been coming up to New Hampshire?
There are a bunch of surprises for a number of candidates. First, I think Jeb Bush understands he can't run the campaign here, his brother did in 2000, and hope to win. And he's working hard. Scott Walker's assembled a good team, but he hasn't been here very much. He was here a month ago and impressed a lot of folks. Marco Rubio's got probably one of the best operatives in New Hampshire, and seems to be picking up some of the Romney folks, and he wowed crowds. Rick Perry has, as his chief organizer and strategist in the state, Mike Dennehy, who was the engineer and architect of the McCain effort in 2000. Rand Paul has got a built-in base like he does in Iowa and is working hard to expand that and has a great campaign team. And sort of a couple dark horses, or three dark horses that I'd point out right now. Carly Fiorina is working, as Jeff was saying, you can't open the paper and see that she's not at yet another spaghetti dinner or pancake breakfast. I don't know whether he's going to get in, but John Kasich came to New Hampshire and did a few events, and he's coming back for this First in the Nation Summit. And people really liked, at least the audiences I saw, really warmed to his message. And then my final one that I'd say is starting to impress is Lindsey Graham. You know, the top issue in New Hampshire right now is the threat of ISIS and national security, and sort of a feeling that whether it's Secretary Clinton's fault or President Obama's fault, that the world is certainly not a safer, more calm place than it was 8 years ago. And that's right in Graham's wheelhouse, probably his wheelhouse more than anybody else's. So those are the ones who I'm seeing, and I'm sure there are going to be some who I've not mentioned, but those seem to be the ones who are doing pretty well so far.
Let me put you both on the spot. Okay, 9.5 months to go. Who wins your state and who's the nominee? Let's start with you, Jeff.
I honestly do not know. You ran through the whole list. If we end up having 15 candidates, at this point, I really believe that 10 of those candidates could be viable. It is that wide open right now. I honestly believe that. I do believe that whoever our nominee is, I agree 100% with Steve. The contrast between our candidates out here slugging it out verbally, debating, getting in front of people, and this coronation that is occurring on the Democratic side and the lack of energy on the Democratic side versus what we seem to have as a continuation of 2014. I'll tell you, I like our chances. My guess is out here in Iowa is that Hillary will improve her third place finish to possibly a second place finish in the general election. I'm hoping that's the best she does after her coronation.
Steve?
You know, I love them all equally, but I will say this. I don't think any poll that's been taken in New Hampshire has any value except for the pollster paid for it. They're just engaging. I think whoever's in first or second now, I think it's either Bush or Walker. That won't necessarily be the case come this fall. And I can make a pretty credible case for about 8 or 10 of our 20 potential candidates who are showing up, actually, all of them showing up in New Hampshire this Friday and Saturday, of a path to winning New Hampshire and the nomination.
Well, then how about this question? Who's going to be the vice presidential running mate, Joni Ernst or Kelly Ayotte?
Well, Kelly Ayotte is not interested in being the vice president. She's interested in doing a great job as the United States senator. Right? I think she's doing a terrific job, and she's running for re-election. So it must have to be Joni Ernst or someone else, because Kelly Ayotte has no interest in being vice president. She has interest in being a senator.
Steve and I can agree on one thing, I believe, and among many, many things I'm sure we can agree on, that is we have two of the best United States senators that this country has to offer.
Amen.
Steve Dupre is the Republican National Committeeman from New Hampshire. He can be found on Twitter at Secretary of Fun. Steve, this is fun to you?
Well, I got that name during the McCain campaign on the Straight Talk Express because I like to remind everybody we weren't there just for a long time. We were there for a good time. And my job was to cheer up the plane and particularly that sometimes grouchy, irascible beast called the press.
Really?
And I did it with everything from shot glasses to tequila shots to aisle surfing to pirate patches and candy, a lot of candy. Somebody called me the Secretary of Fun. It seemed to have stuck.
I was going to say, I like candy and tequila. And Jeff Kaufman is the chairman of the Iowa Republican Party. His Twitter handle is at Kaufman, G-O-P. That's K-A-U-F-M-A-N-N. And G-O-P is spelled G-O-P. Gentlemen, thank you both for being on the program. And we'll be talking to you again and again and again. Thanks both.
You bet.
Thanks.
So what's going on with the Democrats? The only announced candidate got in her campaign Scooby van this week and headed to Iowa.
So I'm hitting the road to earn your vote because it's your time. And and I hope you'll join me on this journey.
8 years ago, Hillary Clinton finished a surprising third in the Iowa caucuses behind Barack Obama and John Edwards. Perhaps with that in mind, Clinton said in her announcement video that the first thing she's doing as a candidate is visiting Iowa. But she's not the first Democratic hopeful to visit the state, and she won't be the last. In the past week alone, both Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, and former Virginia Senator Jim Webb have been in the Hawkeye State trying to measure support. Dr. Andy McGuire has been the Democratic state chair of Iowa since January. Andy, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate it.
It's your job as state party chair to stay neutral, at least for now. But how do you feel about Iowa being the first stop for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's wonderful. We invite all the candidates to come to Iowa and talk to our people, and that's just what she's doing. And as you said, there are other candidates. We invite them all, and we invite anyone else to come talk about the issues that are so important to Iowans.
Is there any fence mending she needs to do in Iowa? I keep reading about things she needs to fix in the aftermath of her campaign 8 years ago. Do you buy that?
You know, as the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, I would hesitate to give her any advice. But I can tell you that Iowans do a great job. They take this job of being caucus first in the nation very seriously. And so they give everyone a fair shake. So I'm not sure that she needs to do anything more than come talk to people, talk about the middle class, talk about education, talk about the future of our kids. Those are the kind of issues people want to hear about. And I'm not sure if it's anything more than just talking to people like we would ask any candidate.
Did she call you before she got on the bus? Were you able to see her this week?
She did call me before she started her journey, yes.
Did you get to see her this week?
I did not, and that's typical just because I'm with a lot of the candidates at different points in the journey, but I'm sure I will. As chair of the party, I usually get with all the candidates.
As chair of the party, I don't mean to put you in a tough position, or maybe I do. No, I don't. But both Martin O'Malley and Jim Webb, you know, have been in Iowa trying to make the case that the party needs a choice, not a coronation. What are you hearing from rank-and-file Democrats?
You know, I'm hearing that it's like all caucuses. We give everybody a fair shot. So I would tell you, people who talk about this being somewhat an overdone or that's coronation, they obviously haven't been in Iowa because that's not how we do things here. We are fair with everyone. And there have been people who have tried to predict the Iowa caucuses before, and I tell you, they don't usually get it right. So I would tell you that we're very fair. We take it seriously. We're going to talk to Governor O'Malley. We're going to talk to Senator Webb. We're going to talk to whomever comes and Hillary Clinton. We're going to talk to all those people, and we're going to make sure that they believe, like we believe, that the middle class is what we're after, that we want to have working families be the focus of what we're doing, and our future is our kids. So that's what I think is happening here.
Do you get a sense that either O'Malley or Webb is making any headway, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell in a large way, but I will tell you there are large crowds where they are, just like there are for all our candidates. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm on the Democratic side.
Earlier this week, Joe Biden was asked about his plans for 2016. He said he has plenty of time to make a decision. Does he?
Well, I encourage everyone to get to Iowa as soon as they can. I wouldn't presume to give him advice, but if I was going to give advice to any candidate, it would be that. I don't think there's a date by which you can't get into this, but the more you can come and talk to our people that are going to caucus, the better off for you. So I would just encourage him to come whenever he can.
Whether the battle for the Democratic nomination is competitive or not, what can you, as party chair, do? What are you planning to do to make sure as many Democrats as possible participate in the caucuses?
Well, that is really important, Ken, is this is really about party building for us. And so there's been a lot of enthusiasm. One of the reasons I've been all over Iowa is to get that enthusiasm going and make sure we're building for the caucuses. You know, this is how we find a lot of our newer candidates and our local office candidates. This is how we get the excitement going that builds then into November of 2016. So that's really what this caucus part is about. Yes, we do a preference for a presidential, but it's really about our congressional candidates. And it's about our lower down the ballot races. So that's really party building at its best, and that's what we do in the caucuses. So we're trying as a party to make sure that everybody knows what they need to be doing about the caucuses and that we get as many people as we possibly can to participate because that's important to us for a victory and turning Iowa blue in 16.
Hillary Clinton has been a presidential candidate for less than a week. Do you have an early assessment?
I'm not sure I do. I would tell you that there's a lot of buzz that she's coming to Iowa and she's talking to people, and that is what we like here. It's our specialty. That's why we're first in the nation. That's what we like, is to talk to people one-on-one and look them in the eye, and that's what she's doing. So just like I would tell every candidate, I think that's a good strategy.
You are so scrupulously fair.
I try. I run the caucus, so I have to be fair. It's very important to us here that we have a fair and transparent caucus and that everybody has a fair shake here.
Dr. Annie McGuire is the State Democratic Party Chair of Iowa. She's on Twitter at DR, that's for Dr. Andy, that's short for Andrea, MC, that's short for McGuire. DR Andy MC. Dr. Andy, congratulations on becoming the State Party Chair, and thanks for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Ken. I appreciate the time.
We'll be talking to you a lot, as you know.
I hope so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As newsworthy as they were, we can't really say we were surprised by the candidacies of Clinton, Rubio, Cruz, and Paul. But one of the more surprising announcements came last week from former Rhode Island Governor and Senator Lincoln Chafee.
I'm Lincoln Chafee, and I am a Democrat considering a run for President of the United States. The 2016 election is an important one for the Democratic Party and for America.
Chafee was appointed to the U.S. Senate in 1999 following the death of his father, John Chafee. Back then, he was a Republican and the mayor of Warwick, Rhode Island. While in the Senate, he was the only Republican to vote against the war in Iraq. He regularly opposed his party on abortion, the environment, and taxes. He said he refused to vote for President Bush in 2004, writing in his father, former President George H.W. Bush, instead. But even in liberal Rhode Island, such liberal positions couldn't save him from losing in the anti-GOP year of 2006. He lost his Senate seat to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Which brings us to that other Whitehouse. And rather than play any more tape from his website, I thought it would be easier to talk to Lincoln Chafee himself. Governor Chafee, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Tell us about what led to your consideration about a potential run for president.
Well, I was very concerned about the direction of the country, internationally in particular, and seeing these wars spread across the Middle East into North Africa, Libya, and into Nigeria, and of course what happened in the Ukraine. I just think we got away from what worked for us as the Berlin Wall came down, the end of the Vietnam era, breakup of the Soviet Union. We were the sole superpower, and I think we made some bad decisions, especially after September 11th. And the worst one, one of the worst decisions in American history, was to invade Iraq, and Senator Clinton voted for that. I was there in the Senate. I voted against it, as you said earlier, and I just didn't think the next president should be one who made such a big mistake.
The war in Iraq is obviously one of the issues you feel most strongly about. And as you pointed out, you know, we pointed out that you opposed it from the beginning. Hillary Clinton, along with Joe Biden and John Edwards and many other, Chris Dodd, many other Democrats, voted for it. And also her foreign policy views are thought to be more hawkish than President Obama's. Do you think this, her Iraqi vote, the foreign policy, do you think that'll be on voters' minds for 2016, or is it looking too far in the past?
No, I think it's relevant today. Yes, it was 12 years ago, the Iraq war vote, but it's just so relevant today with what's happening in the Middle East. It's just total chaos, and it's spread, as I said, into North Africa and elsewhere in the world. ISIS coordinating with Boko Haram in Nigeria. So I think it's going to be relevant, and usually pocketbook issues, local issues dominate, but I do believe, and that's a big reason I'm running, we have to make the world safer for our children and our grandchildren.
Now, another problem, I've heard this from people in the progressive wing of the party, is their claim that Clinton is too close to Wall Street and the banks. Do you think there's going to be a battle over philosophy in the post-Obama Democratic Party?
Yes, I do. Well, yes, we've recovered from the Great Recession and the collapse of our economy, and a lot of questions about how Wall Street contributed to that collapse, I think, need to be asked, and certainly the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party is very adamant, the progressives, about getting Glass-Steagall back and some of the Depression-era laws that kept us away from these collapses of our economy. So I think all these discussions are going to be valid, especially what's happened to the American middle class and the ultra-wealthy gaining in their wealth while everybody else seems to be struggling. We need to fix that.
You're a Democrat, and you said you voted for Barack Obama both times, but for most of your political career, you were a Republican, like your father, and during your 4 years as governor, you were an independent, not a Democrat. So what do you say to Democrats who might feel you came to the party a little late?
Well, I'm a liberal Republican, always have been a liberal Republican, and I have a 30-year record of public service, and I have not changed on the issues. I've been very, very consistent on the protection of the environment, on fiscal responsibility, on using the tools of government, social programs to help build a middle class. I have a 30-year record, and particularly civil liberties, women's reproductive freedoms. So I fit with the Democratic Party, and it's kind of curious, Ken, of the candidates mentioned for this Democratic nomination, Hillary was once Senator Clinton was a Goldwater girl. I was never a right-wing Republican.
And you were never a Goldwater girl.
No. Jim Webb was a Republican. Bernie Sanders is still not a Democrat. So it's an interesting mix.
Going back to your possible candidacy, tell me what you bring to the table that the others don't.
Well, the main thing is this focus on where we're going in the world. I think it's a debate we need to have. I care passionately about it because I feel so strongly that at the turn of the century, especially right before September 11th, we had a moment of looking ahead of a peaceful world, everybody working together, the Germans, the French, the Russians, the Japanese, the Americans, the English, to resolve our problems, whether it's in Bosnia or elsewhere, working together. And we squandered that, and I want to get back to it. So that's really what I bring differently. I was fortunate to serve on the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate, and I chaired the Middle East Subcommittee, and so I feel passionately about these issues. And I know we can do better. I know we can do better with Russia and in the Middle East, with China, with Venezuela. We can make this world better.
The Clinton people are talking about raising $2.5 billion. Now, what are you hoping to raise, and what do you need to raise to be viable?
Well, I'm not going to raise $2.5 billion. I'm not going to be competitive on her scale, but we'll see. It's always about issues, Ken, and money only goes so far. Yes, it's important. I've been in politics, as I said, for 30 years and run in 12 different campaigns, and so I know how important money is, but issues are also important, and I believe I have a good one on where we're going in the world.
You were elected as an independent in Rhode Island. Did you ever think about running for president as an independent?
Well, once I had a chance to talk with Mayor Bloomberg down in his office in New York City, and at the time he was an independent and exploring his own options nationally, and he said it's just impossible. And so if one of the wealthiest men in the world says it's impossible to run for president as independent, it's certainly even more impossible for someone that doesn't have his resources.
There's been a lot of talk of legacies this year. Hillary Clinton's husband was president. Jeb Bush's father and brother were presidents. Rand Paul's father ran for president. Your father was governor and senator. When people complain about political legacies and family dynasties, how come no one's complaining about the Chafees?
Well, I don't know if they will coming down the road, but I think that's some offshoot that these campaigns are so brutal, and the climate out there. I know in my term as governor that the talk radio, and there's been a descent into some real personal level of attacks on people, not on the issues. And so maybe as a result of having grown up in that environment, it's easier for a family to know what they're getting into, knowing that their dad or uncle or whoever it might be has been through that. But it's a different climate from when I first started.
You've only announced your potential intentions about a week ago. What kind of response have you gotten so far?
It's been good, and I think it's going to get better and better, especially as I continue to talk about these issues. It's not just the Iraq war vote. It's the big mistake that Senator Clinton made at the first meeting with the Russians where she had the restart button and had the wrong Russian word for restart, and it was an insult. And set back the attempts we were making to restart better relations with Russia, and we live with those ramifications now. In Venezuela, she referred to their elected president, Hugo Chavez, as a dictator. So these are the issues that I think are going to resonate, because they do affect us internationally, but they also affect us locally, nationally, with our economy. It's a global economy, and we need allies and friends, not adversaries and enemies around the world.
Do you have plans to visit Iowa, New Hampshire, the early states?
Yes, of course. As I said earlier, I've been in 12 different elections, and you've got to get out and meet the voters and listen to them and share your views of the future of the communities, and you're also your record, and I look forward to doing that. I'm excited about it.
How close are you to making a decision?
I would say close. This allows us to get started. This exploratory phase is allowed under the law, and just get our feet on the ground and get started. So I would say somewhere down the road, make it official.
Lincoln Chafee is a former governor and senator from Rhode Island. He recently formed a presidential exploratory committee to consider a bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. Governor Chafee, thank you so much for being on the program.
Have a great afternoon, Ken. It's been a pleasure.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last senator to be indicted while in office who chose to resign? The answer, Harrison Williams, Democrat from New Jersey. Caught in the AppScam scandal, in which FBI agents disguised as Arab sheiks offered bribes to several members of Congress, Williams was convicted of bribery and conspiracy charges in 1980. He always insisted on his innocence.
I'm fighting for justice on every battlefront that I'm on.
You are not going to resign,
Senator? I'm going to fight my case in the United States Senate because I know I didn't do anything wrong, and indeed...
But in 1982, as his colleagues were preparing to expel him from the Senate, he resigned his seat. And the randomly selected winner is William P. Davis of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Bill gets the coveted political junkie button. And the new scuttlebutt puzzle is up and waiting to be solved. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutt puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. For decades, in Chicago, political advancement by the city's black community was always kept in check by the Democratic machine led by Mayor Richard J. Daley. Daley's death in 1976 exposed some of the tensions, but it wasn't until 1983 when there was an actual opening for change. The post-Daley mayors, first Michael Blandick and now Jane Byrne, were seen as failures. Byrne was thought to be so ripe for the picking that Richard M. Daley, son of the late mayor, decided to take her on in the 1983 primary. But also joining the race was Harold Washington, an African-American congressman in his second term.
The machine that ran Chicago doesn't work anymore. Yet Jane Byrne and Richie Daley are still fighting over it. Harold Washington has a different plan.
But while they fight over that machine, I shall fight for Chicago by getting jobs and money from the state and federal government.
Harold Washington.
We can all win.
As Byrne and Daley were splitting the white vote, Washington squeaked by. His coalition of blacks and lakefront white liberals gave him 36% of the vote, just enough to win the primary. Now, that should have been the end of the story. Republicans hadn't won a mayoral election in Chicago since the 1920s. But against a black candidate in Chicago? Who knows? As it turned out, the election became ugly. The GOP candidate, Bernard Epton, used the slogan, "Before it's too late," which seemed to be a pretty clear appeal to race. in a slashing battle that pitted candidates from Chicago's two minority groups, blacks and Republicans, Harold Washington won. That occurred 32 years ago this week. Chris Chandler is a veteran Chicago journalist and a former press secretary to Washington. His book, Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy, was published last year. Chris, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Good to be here, Ken.
Remind us who Harold Washington was.
Harold Washington was the son of a precinct captain, really a lifelong legislator. He was elected to the Illinois House and then the Senate and then to Congress. And his whole life was devoted to political power on behalf of the black community.
Did he think he could win? Did you think he could win that primary?
He thought he could win as long as Jane Byrne and Richard M. Daley were both in the race. And he had a numbers expert down in Hyde Park who worked those numbers very carefully. So he thought he could win. And I had my doubts at the beginning, but then as the campaign gathered steam, I was absolutely committed and convinced we could win.
And then came the general election against Epton. It was a record turnout. I read something like 82% of those who were eligible voted. That's unheard of.
I know. Well, of course, the blacks came out in great numbers supporting Harold. It was amazing. In the Southside wards, it was 98% for Harold. Especially on the far southwest side, it was 98% for Epton. It really came down to black and white in many ways. I want to mention that a key factor in that race was the Latino vote. It was only about perhaps 10% of the vote, but Harold carried that vote overwhelmingly, like 80%. And he did it by joining up with some really progressive leaders in the Mexican and Puerto Rican communities.
So Harold Washington wins in 1983, and then he wins again in 1987. And then just months after he won his second term, he was gone. He died of a massive heart attack. Describe what he did to the city, what you think his legacy was as mayor.
First and foremost was that he appointed a real rainbow government. Blacks, whites, Latinos, Asians, men and women. You know, the government looked totally different than it ever had in Chicago. But beyond that, he did make some specific changes. For instance, he invented the set-aside program where in a city diversity like Chicago, 25% of the city contracts should go to minority firms. Then there's other accomplishments, too. He was the first to recognize public employees have the right to form unions, and he was pro-immigration, which made a big impact on Chicago.
Let me bring in Will Burns. He's the Chicago alderman from the 4th Ward, where Harold Washington lived. Will, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me on, Ken.
In 2013, the 30th anniversary of his election, you were behind the effort to get a Harold Washington Day. Tell me about that.
Well, there were a group of activists who had been involved in Harold's campaign in 83 and 87, and had asked to set up a number of events to commemorate it and ask for a resolution in the city council, and I'm really glad that we did that. It was a great way to honor both Harold and the movement that brought him to power.
Well, I was just talking to Chris about what Harold Washington meant to the city, but when he died in 1987, he was followed by a record 22 years under another mayor for life, Richie Daley, and now we're in a second term with Mayor Rahm Emanuel. I guess my question is, maybe I could ask you both this, question, was Washington just a transitional figure between the two Daleys, or was he more than that?
I would definitely say that Harold Washington was a sort of revolutionary figure. I think that he changed Chicago in ways that we'll never go back to. I mean, I think the political incorporation of African-Americans, Latinos, the LGBT community, that's part of what Chicago is now. I mean, you're not going to have a mayor that's not going to have a diverse cabinet, that's not going to reach out to different constituencies. And, you know, I think that's something that Harold was certainly a part of. And I think the idea of African-American politicians aspiring to be more than congressmen or aldermen or state reps and senators and looking for offices like mayor or U.S. senator or president can certainly be traced back to Harold Washington.
How relevant is Washington's legacy today? The reason I ask you that, I mean, he died nearly 30 years ago before many of your constituents were born.
So when I first started in politics in Chicago, I volunteered for Barack Obama when he was running for state senator in the 1996 cycle, and you'd go knock on doors, you'd go to barbershops and hair salons, and there was always like sort of the triumvirate, right? It was like John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and a faded picture of Harold Washington. And, you know, over time, you know, 20 years later, you know, you don't see as many of those pictures of Harold up anymore and soul food restaurants and people's houses. But I think that you can't underestimate the impact of Harold Washington on Jesse Jackson's decision to run for president in 1984 and the fact that Jesse took the name of the Rainbow Coalition from what Harold created in Chicago. I think that you can't underestimate the impact of Harold Washington on Barack Obama. When I knew the president when he was a state senator, and his focus was on the fifth floor, not necessarily on going to Washington, D.C. He was very interested in one day being mayor of the city of Chicago and being a kind of leader like Harold Washington. I think the idea that African-Americans can appeal to the African-American community and to other racial groups without being a stooge of the Democratic Party is a very important lesson. I think that's one that Carol Mulsey Braun picked up in 1992. So, I mean, he offers a template for progressive African-Americans to get elected to office, and it's sort of lodestone for how to do it.
So many of these conversations are about what-ifs. What's your what-if with Washington? What could he have accomplished had he not died so prematurely? Will, what do you think?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that Harold had real big issues to deal with. I mean, public housing wasn't going anywhere. And at the time in Chicago, public housing was housing of last resort. Chicago public schools were in terrible condition. And he just had the governing majority and the momentum, the second term, to kind of finally address those things. And he dies before he can do it.
Will Burns represents Chicago's 4th Ward on the City Council, Harold Washington's ward. Will, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Chris Chandler, the former press secretary to Harold Washington and author of Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy. Chris, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you.
It was 32 years ago this week on April 12, 1983, when Chicago elected Harold Washington as its mayor, its first black mayor ever. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. The election of Hillary Clinton, of course, would be historic, the first female president. But we saw history being made just over 30 years ago at the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco.
Ladies and gentlemen of the convention, my name is Geraldine Ferraro.
The man who made that history happen is Walter Mondale, the former vice president from Minnesota. He was the Democratic nominee for president in 1984. And he selected Ferraro, a congresswoman from Queens, New York, as his running mate. She was the first woman ever to appear on a major party presidential ticket. Mondale made history in another way as well. He's the first former vice president ever to appear on The Political Junkie. Mr. Vice President, welcome to the show.
Well, I didn't realize I was engaging in this historic day today, but it's an honor to be on this program with you.
It's history in the making, as we like to say.
Right.
You know, we call ourselves political junkies not only because we live, eat, and breathe politics, but we have a reverence for it all, the history, the lore, the people who came before us, especially the history. I alluded to the potential for history being made with Hillary Clinton's election, and that's true with Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz as well. We've never had a Latino president. But that was history in 1984 with your selection of Ferraro. Tell us a little bit about what went into that decision.
One of the important realities of the 84 convention, which I afraid is fading with time, was that there had been a long process of opening up the political party to prevent discrimination based on race or gender, to make the nominating process more open and fair, to include all of America in our conventions. And while this sounds like 4th of July rhetoric, many of the top political scientists and reporters covering the 84 convention remarked about how our party had changed and was more of all of those things I've discussed. And I think nothing underscores that more than the Geraldine Ferraro's selection. I spent a lot of time reviewing who I might pick as a running mate, and as I got down to it, I decided that Ferraro would help in so many ways. First of all, she's bright. She had an excellent record in the Congress. Tip O'Neill told me she's the person you need. And I was hoping that she would give some life to the process. You know, one of the big problems in politics is boredom. And this offered to America an entirely different version of what America should be about. And I think, although we got clobbered, I think that the message was sent that was deep and profound.
Well, we all know that vice presidents don't usually sway the election. Maybe Lyndon Johnson did. I'm not sure if there was anyone else. But looking back to that decision, a proud moment? Any regrets?
No. I made a choice there. I knew it was risky. I wanted to take a chance. I wanted to speak out on the issues we just discussed. I liked and like Geraldine Ferraro. She was a great running mate. No, I don't have any regrets.
You were the Attorney General of your home state of Minnesota when you were appointed to the Senate to replace Hubert Humphrey, who was elected vice president.
That's right.
How does one fill the shoes of Hubert Humphrey?
Good question. They're a big pair of shoes, as you know. He was one of the great politicians that I've ever known and a reformer to his core. All the great issues of civil rights, Medicare, health care reform, and so on, you'll find Humphrey's tracks all over them. So when he was selected by Johnson to be his running mate, it was a big deal here in Minnesota and around the country. I think people applauded that. And it opened up the question of who would replace him in the Senate. And I'll always be honored by the fact that I was picked for that with Hubert's help.
Well, speaking about Humphrey, in many ways, he had a tortured vice presidency. He was loyal to Lyndon Johnson, but he was desperate to break free from his Vietnam policy when he was running for president. When Jimmy Carter picked you as his running mate, did you think about Humphrey's plight and what path you might take as VP?
I did. As a matter of fact, I was discouraged by what Humphrey went through that you've just described. I mean, I think that if you look back on it, Humphrey would have been far better off to stay in the Senate where he was a free man and where he enjoyed massive national support. When he went into the vice presidency, he was eclipsed by Lyndon Johnson. And, of course, the war was a disaster early in their administration. Humphrey wrote a letter to Johnson saying, let's watch out, this war in Vietnam's going to be a real tragedy. Let's try to steer away from it. Johnson didn't like that and sort of chilled Humphrey for some months, sort of cutting him out of the administration. And Humphrey tried to reclaim some stature there. And there's no question that one of the war's greatest victims, other than those who have been injured and killed in it, was the career and the psyche of Hubert Humphrey.
You came to the Senate the same time as Bobby Kennedy did. And there were a lot of giants in the Senate back then, Everett Dirksen, Phil Hart, Richard Russell. Do you recognize today's Senate at all?
Yes and no. I think there's a lot of good senators. We got two of them from Minnesota. They're excellent. Klobuchar and Franken. But the way the Senate works now, the way the rules have throttled and paralyzed action in the Senate, particularly the growth of the right-wing ideologues in the Senate that get elected on a program of paralyzing the country, they had made progress, reform, almost impossible in the Senate. And the Senate, when we were around, was almost the cutting edge of reform. Has now become just the opposite. You know, I'm hoping things will change, but I sure don't see it yet.
We were talking about the vice presidency earlier, and we talked about the unhappiness that Hubert Humphrey had as VP. And, of course, we do know that LBJ hated leaving the Senate to be vice president. He was unhappy in that position, too.
But you know, there's that wonderful story. Johnson got elected vice president, and, of course, being Johnson, I know you've covered him. You know what I'm talking about. He wanted to remain a part of the Senate caucus, and he wanted to be chairman of the Democratic Senate caucus. When the caucus found that out, they kicked Johnson out of the caucus, so he was not in the power structure of the Senate. So he gave up, he found, this all-powerful position as leader of the Senate to become sort of a cipher in the office of vice president. And he took it very hard.
Well, until you became vice president, the job seemed to be mostly ceremonial, but you seemed to become the first with real duties, real authority. How was your time in that position?
You asked a couple of good questions I didn't answer, but let me get back to them. I went to see Humphrey before any of this, and I said, you know, I got a shot at the vice presidency, but do I want it? I know what you went through. Could this happen to me? Why should I give up a good sentence? And Humphrey argued, no, do it. He said, you'll learn more about the world than you can in the Senate. You will grow as a public leader. If you have a chance, you have to take this and try to make something out of it. Another series of conversation I was having was with Dick Moe, the head of my office, and with others, and finally with Carter and the people around him, about changing the vice presidency. And what came out of that was that as new vice president moved into the West Wing, we had an agreement. It's still in, it's in writing. It's almost like a part of the Constitution now, but it was just a memo from Dick Moe to me. And I went to the Carter and I said, I'd like to be your general advisor. I would like to have access to all the inside information and to you when necessary. And I'd like to do troubleshooting in the Congress, around the country, and internationally. He agreed to all of that. And we cut out a lot of that old fighting that you used to report on. And it worked. And I think the reforms that succeeded under Carter and myself have been copied roughly. If you look at Joe Biden, you see the elements of our vice presidency change to suit Biden and Obama, and I think it's been very successful.
You mentioned Joe Biden. I mean, he's been a loyal vice president for two terms. And so as a former vice president yourself, do you feel for the situation he's in? I mean, are you saddened that it looks like he'll never get his chance to move up?
I think he's really glad to be vice president. He looks happy to me. I know that he would like to be president. Every vice president has that thought. But whether that will work now, I don't know. It doesn't look likely, but let's face it, Joe Biden's had a long, wonderful, spectacular public career. He's the second most important person in public life in America, and because of that around the world, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't want to bet, but I think he's got to be pretty happy with where he is.
Going back into your career, you had, of course, a debate with fellow vice presidential candidate Bob Dole in 1976, who famously growled about those who died in Democrat wars.
Yeah.
But that didn't compare to when you squared off against President Reagan in 1984 and this memorable line.
You already are the oldest president in history, and some of your staff say you were tired after your most recent encounter with Mr. Mondale. I recall yet that President Kennedy had to go for days on end with very little sleep during the Cuba Missile Crisis. Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to function in such circumstances?
Not at all, Mr. Truitt, and I want you to know that also I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit for political purposes my opponent's youth and inexperience.
I still remember, Mr. Vice President, I still remember your reaction to that. I mean, you were laughing. We were all laughing. But
yeah.
I want to know what went through your mind at that time. Many people have written that the election was settled at that very moment. Do you think so?
It might have been. As you recall, the first debate, Reagan had performed miserably.
Yes.
Seemed to forget his lines. And it was, I thought, a very painful night for Reagan. And in fact, after that first debate, we started building in the polls. It looked like maybe we had a chance. Well, then the second debate, he came on. He was alive. He was engaged. I think he'd worked on that joke for some time, and it worked. You know, I could have argued, look, I'm in my mid-50s. That's not too young. I've had a decade of experience in the Senate and as vice president. I decided I wouldn't do any of that. I just let that sit where it was.
We're doing this interview on tax day, so I have to ask you this question. You said something in your 1984 acceptance speech that was either the bravest thing anyone could possibly say or was the most foolish. Here's that tape.
I mean business. By the end of my first term, I will reduce the Reagan budget deficit by two-thirds. Let's tell the truth. That must be done. It must be done. Mr. Reagan will raise taxes, and so will I. He won't tell you. I just did.
It's not often you find a politician who says, elect me, I'm going to raise your taxes.
A couple of years after that statement, the governor of New Jersey at a public meeting said, I'm saying, you know, Fritz, you damn fool, I told you to raise taxes after the election, and I talk about it. But, you know, it may have hurt me, but I once again, I did what I thought was right. It still bothers me that people run for office knowing damn well that taxes have to be raised, sort of avoid the discussion, and then after the election discover, oh, look at here, we've got a deficit. And so I feel good about the fact that I told the truth. I think maybe people looking back at it may have appreciated it more than they did on election day. But I don't know. I hear many people tell me that it was a bad mistake. But there you have it.
You've been through the political wars for decades. You've seen so much, accomplished so much. Looking back, is there a signature Walter Mondale moment?
I'm going to say it was at that convention where we finally showed America a political party that had opened up, had reformed itself away from discrimination of all kinds, and it invited a whole new generation of young Americans that represented the whole country. I think that, if you ask me what I was proudest of, it's having been a part of those reforms.
Walter Mondale was the 42nd Vice President of the United States, serving under Jimmy Carter from 1977 to 1981. He was the Democratic nominee for president in 1984, and he selected Geraldine Ferraro as his running mate, the first woman of either major party to appear on a national ticket. Mr. Vice President, it was wonderful speaking with you today.
Thank you, Ken. Hope to see you one of these days.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
And speaking of Tax Day, we've put together a montage of tape to remind you that April 15th is upon us. Oh, wait. It's already passed? That's okay. We filed an extension. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
Throw out the current tax code and pass the 9% business flat tax, the 9% personal income tax, and the 9% national sales tax.
'Cause I'm the tax man.
We need to change our tax code so that people like me and an awful lot of members of Congress pay our fair share of taxes.
I believe that in both spirit and substance, our tax system has come to be un-American.
I raise the corporate tax to the international average to make a contribution to drive the debt down.
I happen to believe lower taxes is what stimulates economic growth, and what we need now in a country is economic growth.
As long as we're steeped in history, you may well know that this week was the 150th anniversary of the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln. Which reminds me of a very special podcast moment years ago when Ron Elving and I did It's All Politics for NPR. How could I not remind you of that classic moment?
You know, Ray LaHood, by the way, represents a part of Illinois that's very close to the part of Illinois around Springfield that Abraham Lincoln represented in Congress back in the 1850s.
That's right.
And we just learned this week, by the way, something interesting about Abraham Lincoln's face.
He's on the $5 bill?
No, his face. He was asymmetrical.
He didn't like Jews? Actually, that's not true because he was shot in the temple. Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
Before we go, we'd like to welcome a new member to the Political Junkie family. Devin Maverick Robbins, a former NPR producer who has worked on Talk of the Nation, Tavis Smiley, as well as many podcasts, has joined the team as editor and producer. We're thrilled to have her. And that's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our producers this week are A.D. Quigg and Devin Robbins, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.